This is JS Party, a weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. Connect with us in our community Slack. It's totally free. Head to jsparty.fm/community and sign up today. Thank you to our partners for helping us bring you world-class developer pods each and every week. Shout out to Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. Okay, hey, it's party time, y'all. Hello, Internet. I'm Jared, your friend, and I'm here joined by some master debaters. I have K-Ball with me. What's up, K-Ball?
I'm looking forward to this one. Hello.
Good to have you. And Amel is back. What's up, Amel?
Hey, hey. I need a soundboard effect right now. Like, you know, dung dung, you know, like Law and Order meets like Rocky.
Hold tight. I'll get you something.
We love JavaScript. We addicted to it. We love it all the time. We want it in our veins. Give me more. More, more.
There's your soundboard for you.
That's a new one. Okay. I'll take it.
Do you remember saying that?
I mean, vaguely. But yeah. All right. I'll take it.
That's a cool one. I like that one.
That's a cool one. That's a very cool one.
And we're joined by a special guest debater. It's Eric Clemens. Eric, welcome to JS Party.
Hey, happy to be here.
Ooh, brought his own soundboard.
I don't have a soundboard.
Yeah. We'll fix that up in post. Amel, why don't you? So Amel invited Eric to debate with her. He's on your team. So why don't you do the proper intro and tell folks who Eric is so he doesn't have to?
Yeah. Eric Clemens is like a JavaScript gentleman from Texas. I don't know if that's even giving you justice. He's a huge open sourcer, incredible lead engineer. He's worked at a number of places. We spent some time together at Stripe. And he's just kind of just overall, I don't know, I'm going to get bleeped. He's just a JavaScript badass. Really, really into kind of like solving problems when it comes to the developer experience. He's got some really cool libraries out there. One's called Click to Component and lets you kind of inspect your elements real time. He's got some other really cool utils around testing. I don't know. Eric is just awesome. And he's, you know, I've wanted to have him on the show for a while and glad he's finally on, but I'll let him introduce himself.
Here he is.
So.
Yeah, did she miss anything, Eric? Anything to add?
I don't think there is. I'm kind of blushing and tearing up at the same time. That's really sweet. But yeah, the DX part is a very huge aspect of it. Anywhere that there's friction in the experience, got to burn it with fire. You know, kind of like console log and, you know, print debugging. That sort of
thing. Oh, he's beginning. The debate hasn't begun yet, Eric. So for our longtime listeners.
Those are baked in. Why you got to add friction?
K-Ball, the debate hasn't begun. Okay, let's hold it back. You know, they're chomping at the bit here. So longtime listeners know that we routinely do debate episodes where we pick a premise and then we assign people to a side. They don't get to pick their side because that wouldn't be as fun. And we debate whether or not that premise is true or false, but we don't call it true or false. We call it yep and nope because of our friend Alex Sexton's classic yep nope.js feature detection library from way back in the jQuery days. Alex was actually one of the original panelists on JS Party, so it's a nod to him. It's called a yep, nope, and we're going to play that today. Today's premise, if you haven't guessed already, is about debugging. And the question that we're trying to answer is print debugging good enough? So print debugging, what is that? Well, that's any time that you're just putting print statements in, however you happen to do that, most likely in our world, console.log, it used to be alert debugging. You'd have an alert statement and you would try to put some stuff in there and it'd pop out and you'd read it and it'd say object, object. And then you wouldn't have any help from that whatsoever. But console log is significantly better than the bad old days. But is it enough? Is print debugging good enough? Arguing the positive will be K-Ball and your humble moderator, even maybe not so humble moderator, me. I will be arguing today because scheduling conflicts. So that's the upside. And on the nope side, arguing that print debugging is not good enough will be Eric and Amel. We do this semi-formal. So we actually have a timer and we have a buzzer, but we also have a shoestring budget. So our buzzer noise is Chris Hiller saying what? So if you hear this sound,
what?
Your time is up. And if you don't stop talking, I will hit that button profusely. Until you do. I might even do it to myself, which would be weird.
I might just break out into song if, you know, What? You know, you can like put a beat to that.
I'm never going to stop you from singing it, Mel. I'm just sitting here in anticipation. So
it's okay.
Whenever you break out in a song, I'm here for it.
It's okay.
Because we need more soundboards, you know?
Eric, do you beatbox? Y'all could do a duo. Go on, Mel.
Oh, gosh. On demand isn't the way it works. You know, it's when it comes. It comes in its own schedule. You know,
she may be the Beyonce of the web platform, but she's not actually Beyonce.
Right. That is very accurate. Many levels. Yeah. But there's some guitars behind Eric. For those of you listening, Eric plays a lot of music. Yeah,
that's true. Eric, are you musical?
I am. Yeah. This is part of the compromise to move to Texas from like Seattle was I got to bust out all my musical instruments again. In Seattle, just didn't have the room for the instruments, but now I do.
I was going to say you got a drum kit back there as well.
Yep. My very first drum set I found when I was like 6 in a church dumpster. And so haven't been able to quit playing drums since.
Wow. What kind of music do you play?
Honestly, just anything I'm listening to in the car that sounds like it has a good beat. I come home and basically just replay it.
Very cool. Well, we will cue you later to begin singing. I'm sure Amel will work you in. Let's start this debate before we lose all of our listeners. And the debate hasn't begun. So 2 minutes on the board, okay? You'll have 2 minutes to state your case, and then we'll rotate back and forth between teams. So we will start with our guests. Well, our guest is Eric. Amel, you're on his team. Ladies will go first. So we'll let Amel go first. And you are arguing no. Print debugging is not good enough. There's 2 minutes on the board. Amel, let's hear it.
Thank you, Jared. And hello, listeners. Print debugging is certainly one way to do it. It's not wrong, but the web has evolved. You know, we have so many better ways to debug and inspect. There's, you know, lots of engineers that have created awesome tools and protocols that allow you to kind of connect with your code in a more intimate way than just logging statements. And so why would you limit yourself to just a bunch of logs, which, you know, aren't always even, you know, you never know where you're even logging from sometimes, you know, unless you're in a node environment and you can like, you know, print a context as well. And so, you know, logs are great, but there's so much more. And hopefully Eric and I will be getting into all the things. And, you know, with all the new features that have come into Chrome DevTools, which is kind of a shared universal protocol between a lot of browsers, why limit yourself to just logs? You can do things like even mock your HTTP headers now. And so, you know, we've gone way beyond the days of just kind of breakpoints. You know, we're now able to manually trigger errors and say like, hey, I want to kind of always have this network request fail. And so let's see how resilient my app is for when this network request fails. You can do all kinds of things like conditional breakpoints. You can watch all the variables in your execution context. There's so much. So why limit yourself to just logs? There's more than logs.
What?
All right. Very good. Opening case by Amel. K-Ball, make our opening case for us, please.
All right. Amel, in previous debates, you have said something along the lines of just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. You have argued about the dangerous path that extensive developer experience focused tooling like React and other things have led us towards and how that those are poisonous for the web. And so I want to say, as developers, we got to master the basics. We got to stay with what's real, what's built in, what works well. And when it comes to debugging, that is console log or printf debugging. You know, it's a keep it simple, stupid type of situation, right? Like, keep it simple. This is all you need. What are you doing in debugging? You're trying to understand the state of things as they're going along. And you said something like, you never know where you're logging from. Have you ever heard of logging? I got here. Like, that's a core to printf debugging. I got here too. Keep it going.
So fun.
But in a slightly more serious frame, there are so many different environments that you're going to want to debug in. Sometimes you're able to debug something totally locally. Other times, a problem doesn't emerge until you're out in production, you're in a distributed application, you have race conditions and all these other things. And the thing that all of these fancy debugging tools do so much of the time is they will freeze you in time. But now you have gotten rid of your race condition. Your bug goes away. You get a Heisen bug. And if that's how you teach yourself to debug, you'll never be able to use the tooling that happens in real time, flowing out data and giving you that availability. Console.log becomes observability in production. It becomes lets understand the state of many things happening at once, and it becomes a foundation for you to debug all of those complicated environments and other situations that show up outside of your packaged development environment.
What?
All right. Perfectly coming in on time, like a like the pro that he is, like the winner that he's going to be. Eric, it's now your turn to spend 2 minutes talking about logging or not logging. Go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, K-Ball's not wrong. I mean, if you have like one tool in your tool belt, you know, that tool looks pretty good. And it pays to be proficient with a lot of other tools. Because, I mean, if we talk about logging, yeah, that's one piece of it. But it's missing the rest of the history of how we even got there, especially if we talk about the user's machine. You know, if you're console logging, you're on your machine. You've already gone into the code base. What about everything else that happened before then? What made their environment unique? Those race conditions that only they got to see because they have a different environmental config or different browser, or maybe even like a different backend configuration that you're just not aware of that doesn't match what you've been testing or, you know, developing against. So yeah, it's a tool we've had. There's not a lot of friction to it. It kind of reminds me of that meme, you know, where there's cavemen with a square wheel and someone else offers them a round wheel and they're like, no, thanks, we're too busy. Yeah, if you like to be effective, I mean, we could learn from other people in the industry. You know, for example, Next.js, big topic, has just like launched like their app router. And Tim Newkins has even mentioned that like there's 20 super complicated bugs that would have taken them days to reproduce and actually investigate if it wasn't for improved logging tools. So half of the story is actually what's going on in the user's machine who isn't a developer, who doesn't have console log developing. So, you know, it's not no to debugging, but maybe just grabbing the wrong tool for the job.
What?
All right. I will now respond. It's interesting, Eric, that you mentioned improved logging tools. We're all for improved logging tools. We want the best logging tools that there are. But at the end of the day, these are logging tools, and logging is good enough. Print statements are good enough. K-Ball mentioned the KISS principle, right? Keep it stupid simple. I'll also mention this. You want to be able to learn something that's transferable. So I have logging skills, and I've worked in many different areas with many different languages and many different runtimes, and my ability to print stuff has paid off everywhere I've gone. Now, I also learned a little bit of GDB, the GNU debugger, and let me tell you how inscrutable that tool is. And I learned how to use it, and I got some value out of it, and then I went into the web browser, and I realized 0% of my GDB skills actually transfer into the web browser. And so now I invested a bunch of time learning a very sophisticated, powerful power tool, and I couldn't take that anywhere. Now I could dive into Chrome DevTools and learn all the intricacies of Chrome DevTools, and maybe they'll change and that my knowledge will be gone, or I'll switch to the backend. And all of a sudden, I don't know the backend tools. And so there's a real value in simple tools, easy to learn, easy to transfer, and good enough to get the job done most of the time. Now, I still have 40 seconds left, so I will start our classic move of appealing to authority, and I will read some quotes at this time. Quote, I don't like debuggers. Never have. Probably never will. End quote. Linus Torvalds. Quote, after over 30 years of programming in assembler, Fortran, C, C++, etc., I feel no desire to use a debugger. Neil Butterworth. Quote, I've met junior developers who feel like they don't know how to use a debugger, or they don't know what they're doing, and they just put print statements out. That's completely legitimate. In fact, it tends to be my go-to thing doing that. Matt Ryer.
What?
And my time is up. Thus concludes round one of our debate. So far, the yeps have it. The nopes are struggling, but we'll see what happens in round two. Amel, we're back to you. You now have 1 minute. You can answer any of the things that we've said, or you can just go off and say whatever it is you like for 1 minute.
Can we first start by acknowledging that the moderator is the non-neutral party? And so you get to add to the hype factor of your team, which, you know, really, I mean, let's be honest. Is it a tool? Is logging a tool, or is it just like a thing?
Is this your time? Okay, I'm going to start your time. You're just launching into an argument before your time
starts. I'm rolling it.
Okay, your timer is going, Amel.
This is preparation for the reality of the corporate world. The moderator is always biased.
Oh, right. It's a hard, cold lesson in capitalism or something. But okay, so yeah, logging, as Eric mentioned, not wrong, right? It's certainly a thing that you could do. But given the variety of options that you have at your disposal when trying to problem solve, why limit yourself to the most rudimentary option, right? So when you, for example, are able to actually stop at a breakpoint and inspect your code and see where, you know, you can look at the call stack, you're able to look at not only how you got here, but where your logic is, you know, because of the variables and all the things in scope, you know, where you're going to potentially head to next.
What?
There's so many other options. Why limit yourself to logging? I mean, for me, that's the ultimate argument.
What?
All right, K-Ball, 1 minute.
Let's be real. Debugging is a means to an end, right? The point is not the debugging process. It's to find that stinking bug and get rid of it. And you could do the classic developer thing, which is, you know, spend your 3 weeks learning your tools, digging in, getting it set up, perfect debugger, learning the changes that happened since the last release statement, and then your 1 day to debug. Or you could use the same tools that have been working the same way since the dawn of programming and get to your bug a heck of a lot faster. And I know as developers, we love to dig into fancy tools. Like that's one of the reasons we got into development. And it's great if you're doing it for fun. But if your goal is debugging and getting to the end of that bug, stick with a tool that you already know that works well, that's going to be transferable, as Jared said, and fix your bug that much faster.
What?
Coming in.
Or slower.
Right on time. All right, Eric, your turn.
Right on. Is that like, I think it's wise for us to recognize that code is a means to an end. But it's also pragmatic to say that like how we work, how we do the job that people are paying us to do, the faster we can shorten that time between that's not doing the thing that we paid you to do, make it do the thing that we paid you to do, is in the best interest of the company and also kind of what makes you valuable as an employee. So there are going to be non-transferable skills, you know, at any sort of job, who to talk to, what the bug tracking system is, how the release management process works, what the code base even looks like is going to be different from the last place. That's largely non-transferable. So if we level up our tools to be able to get us to where is the problem actually happening and let us get us into a reproducible state faster, as fast as it was for the user to experience that bug, that's going to shave off a ton of time of us trying to set up an environment, us trying to do console logging, replaying, you know, and constantly like changing our print statements until we can actually identify where it was, where we could have had the information to begin with.
What?
Versus throwing it away.
1 minute for me. I will now continue reading quotes off of the internet. No, I'm just kidding. But I will mention that I have polled the audience, our changelog community, and 55% of respondents mostly use print statements, and only 45% mostly use a debugger. So there's wisdom in the crowd, and proficient Crowdly devs find print statements to be good enough, as do I. So I will now tell an anecdote of my life. I have been developing software for 20 plus years, various stages of quality. And so that can be up to the reader of the code, I suppose. But I put out production systems and I've built all kinds of things. And like I said, back in the day, I learned GDB and I learned how to use a debugger and I see the value in it. Ultimately, the ROI on that tool is lower than I'm willing to invest. And so as I move on in my life to the next phase, oh my gosh, I just got started. Hold on. I now allow myself 20 more seconds.
Just going to lean on that scale a little more there.
I'll stop because I am a fair moderator. I'm not biased. I'll stop right there. But y'all know where I was driving with that little story. And I was going to a really good place. Okay. We'll give Amel one more minute. Do you want another minute? You got anything else to say? Or are you all out of arguments?
Yeah, sure.
All right, go ahead.
I feel like I've been arguing, you know, against logs, but really what I should be doing is arguing for all the things that you can do, like beyond logging, right? So look at how the web has evolved. So we have tools like Lighthouse that like allow you to kind of debug all kinds of issues in your application real time. And that's something that you can't do from a logger. You can record your performance. You can look at your heaps and get snapshots of kind of, you know, how much bandwidth you're utilizing or, you know, device compute you're utilizing. You can figure out how long API requests are taking. There's all this kind of conversational, there's kind of a huge conversational element, you know, and almost like a query-like element to debugging, which, you know, you can't get from just plain logs, you know? And so...
What?
Yeah. Why limit yourself?
K-Ball, one more minute.
The world is...
What?
You're done.
It's a big place out there.
Listener, disregard the last thing Amel said. It didn't count. It was outside of the time. Okay, K-Ball, go.
So I think fundamentally we might be disagreeing about what logs are, right? So when I want to debug something that happened to a user in production, I go and I look at the information I have about what happened to them. It's in my logs. I go and look up the exception trace. What was the exception that threw? That's a log. I go and look at my observability of like, okay, how many other people have hit this? What are the data on that? That's an aggregation of logs. Fundamentally, logs is what's underneath all of these advanced tools. And if we start from thinking about what data do we need to log, and I don't just mean what data do I need to log now to debug this problem that I'm doing now, but if I start from a log-centric mindset, I am thinking about what do I need to be logging throughout my application's path such that when something goes wrong, I have the information that I need in order to track down what it was. Because I can't predict what it is going to go wrong or when it's going to go wrong. I don't have a controlled environment for when things go wrong for users.
What?
So I need to be thinking from a log mindset, what needs to be there for that future self?
Log mindset.
Do not pay attention to the last thing K-Ball said. Unless it was really good for you, then go ahead and keep it. All right, Eric, final statements. You got 1 minute. Go, sir.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to talk about how we like store data, like the HAR files that we record in browsers and you know, everything we store is going to be, I mean, we might as well say yep to JSON and I'll be on the same page and end the show now. But it's more to that. It's like if we look at the patterns that when logging is good enough, we're seeing engineers keep, you know, some like that quote earlier is just that, like I see junior engineers, but yeah, because it's a low level tool and primitive. You learn that day one of programming. But if you want to stay at a junior level debugging experience, then that's perfectly fine. But as we improve and grow, one of the things that we should be doing is having faster, rapid iteration loops. And a lot of that comes from leveraging the tools that are applicable to the environment we're in, that's in the stack that we're in the company that we're in, and using those tools so that way we can go from zero to fixed as soon as possible. And if that means moving console statements around, you can just look at the number of typing, you know, like how many key presses you've been using to debug something to realize that this is kind of an inefficient process. If you could have gotten to what the end result is faster, where that undefined came from,
what?
You know, you'd be done.
Okay. So as moderator, I will defer my final minute in order to tally the results. And we had, let's see, carry the three. Okay, over here. Wow. After this scientific result calculating, it turns out that for the first time in Yep Nope history, Jared didn't win. We all win.
With win, 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 we all win.
So congratulations to both sides for presenting excellent cases. We all win, guys. How does it feel?
Not rigged.
All right. Well, dear listener, obviously you have a real winner in mind. And so you can email us, you can tweet at us, and you can just tell us it was me, and then we'll feel better about it. But I'm not going to declare myself the winner because I've transcended such things. But finally, at the end of the day, we're happy because we all are going to find that stinking bug.
Aha! I found ya, you stinking bug!
This is a Changelog Newsbreak. OpenObserve is a cloud-native observability platform built specifically for logs, metrics, traces, and analytics, designed to work at petabyte scale.
Huge!
According to its creators, quote, "It's very simple and easy to operate as opposed to Elasticsearch, which requires a couple dozen knobs to understand and tune. With OpenObserve, you can get up and running in under 2 minutes. It's a drop-in replacement for Elasticsearch if you're just ingesting data using APIs and searching using Kibana. Kibana is not supported nor required with OpenObserve. OpenObserve provides its own UI, which does not require separate installation, unlike Kibana." End quote. An interesting offering indeed. Here's a couple choice quotes from the comments section. User GetTutaChapa says, quote, "I just tried this 3 days ago. As someone running the home lab and hadn't set up logging yet, it was a great find. I didn't have to learn and combine 3+ log technologies. It's just a single all-in-one monitoring server with web UI, dashboards, log, filtering/search, etc. RAM usage of the Docker container was under 100 megabytes. end quote. And user SurgeAx says, quote, interesting product. Thank you for the effort. Definitely want to give it a try. For me, though, setting up a system is not the primary pain point today. For what it's worth, signing up for a cloud service is not hard. The problem starts at the ingestion point, end quote. You just heard one of our five top stories from Monday's Changelog News. Subscribe to the podcast to get all of the week's top stories and pop your email address in at changelog.com/news to also receive our free companion email with even more developer news worth your attention. Once again, that's changelog.com/news. And thus ends our yep, nope debate, but we're not finished talking. So let's now just discuss freely amongst ourselves. No timers, no moderator, no Jared winning everything, but just giving you guys an olive branch and saying that we all won, even though we really know what happened. Instead of all that, let's just discuss debugging tools, techniques. What do y'all do? Are you representing the side that you actually believe in? I will say that I do use console logging for most situations. There are obviously scenarios where you get a particularly sophisticated bug and you do need a little bit more firepower in that circumstance. And so I will move on from there. But I do find that for most things, it's enough to use console log. And because of the power of the dev tools, console.log has so many features like right click, store as global variable, you know, like that's basically print debugging, but it's going beyond print debugging, isn't it? Because now you're actually interacting with the environment as it is, and that's incredibly useful for diving into an object and seeing what data's there and all that. So that's my actual take, is I do mostly do print statements, but I also like to hop into the runtime and stop things and try things when it's sophisticated or difficult, or when print statements aren't quite good enough, even though mostly they are. So that's what I'm thinking. Eric, what's your stance? How do you debug? What are the tools that you use in these circumstances?
It's a lot of the same. And really the biggest problem isn't so much of like where to put that print statement, or if I'm going to run, you know, like Node Inspector and debug this thing in Chrome instead of breakpoints. I find actually breakpoints to be more of a hindrance. I've recently learned how to do like the variable watching, which has been way more useful for me to just say, let me know what this value is and how it changes. Anything that kind of like, we talked about race conditions earlier, K-Ball, it's like, it's kind of like that example is that like, I want to see the thing run and play and then just get into an iteration loop. But that's not really where the friction is. Most of the friction for me is trying to get to the reproducibility part, is all the stuff outside of my control. I've spent so much time over my career trying to have reproducible environments and trying to like log in as and impersonate some special user session. And that, I mean, there's tools solving for that now, but I see that as being where like most of the works on my machine issue is coming from. The code part has become easy to actually debug once you have reproducibility.
Good point. Reproducibility is killer. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the work is just getting to that spot or finding that spot. Yeah.
Yeah. I would second that breakpoints can be annoying AF. However, helpful AF. However, you know, I think for me that, you know, I didn't want to argue this earlier because, you know, I wasn't team log, but, you know, console log has really gotten very souped up. There's really smart things you can do now. There's console assert that lets you kind of do a conditional console log where you, you know, can say your first parameter is like what your truthy or falsy value is, right? So you can do a check to say like, if this is true, then do a log, right? So if you don't want to end up...
That is such a useful tactic.
So good.
So helpful.
Yeah. I mean, it's like way better than a breakpoint because then you don't have to like, you know, find, there's like all this context switching, right? So there's, you know, that. And then just, you know, being able to kind of also view your data in a richer way, like things that you're logging with console table, console dir, whether you're trying to kind of open up arrays or objects, there's nice ways to kind of prettify the data that you're printing. So logs are great. But for me, you know, there's just nothing more beautiful than also just typing debugger semicolon and just letting your code rip, like run, right? And being able to just kind of inject a breakpoint from code. Like, I think that's also just really nice. And that's something that I don't see developers like utilize enough. Like, you know, you don't have to kind of futz about. However, I think some of our pain points around using breakpoints have like greatly smoothed over in recent versions of Chrome. Everything from kind of like auto-ignoring third-party scripts. Like, don't you hate it when you're just like trying to like walk,
yes,
like get to a place and then it's like, why am I in all this obfuscated JavaScript that I haven't written, like get me out of here, right? So being able to ignore third-party scripts and then being able to even just click on entire directories from within your debugger and just say ignore, right? Like your node modules or any other directory that you want to ignore. So there's lots of kind of nice UX improvements, I think, that have happened around working with breakpoints. So I think if it's been a while, or if you've, if you've hated breakpoints your whole life, like I'd say give them another chance. I think there's a lot of really nice improvements that have come in over the past year and a half. So
I think it's also worth pointing out that there's kind of different kinds of debugging, because a lot of the debugging that I do is actually just development, right? So like I'm actively coding and I'm just like shaking out bugs while I'm coding. And so in those cases, like console log is darn near all you need, right? Because you're like coding, you're doing a thing, you're like, okay, this is not working. What's wrong with this object here? Okay, I'm going to print it. I'm going to look at it. Okay, no wonder it didn't have this property. Okay, go back to my code. And so I'm debugging while I code. In that case, I do like to stop the world every once in a while, but I don't find it to be super useful. But then you have the one that is like somebody opens a ticket and it's like, okay, this, and it comes back to what Eric was talking about with reproducibility. Like, it's like this bug exists in production and it exists for this user, right? At this time of day, they happen to live in San Diego, but the production database is in Tokyo or something. And now you're like, okay, I'm not like actively doing stuff. I'm just like here to solve a problem. Where do I start? And a lot of the difficulty is, well, how do I get my system that I'm working on to look like production, to look like that user? And Eric, you mentioned like shadowing techniques or like login as or masquerading as a user kind of things, which those stuff's very valuable, but you end up having to develop that yourself, or you have to like buy a system that allows you to do that. So these are like, a lot of times I think that's the really complicated part of debugging.
Having a local production environment, something that connects to the production databases but lets you reproduce in a local environment, is super helpful for that. That was something that I hadn't seen that much, and then my last job had that and I was like, oh, like this is really cool.
Are there guardrails around that?
In that case, there were. So the default was you were in read-only mode. So you could log in, you're accessing it, but you're read-only, like writes are just ignored. And that was implemented at the data layer. So like there was, it would have been very, very hard to mess that up. That was the biggest guardrail. There were others. There's like a banner on, oh, you are in
right
production mode or whatever. Be careful. Things like that. But
so that's something that somebody at your previous employer put together, right?
They built. Yeah. Yeah. And it was easier to do in that environment because they were operating in a world where even the development environment was connecting to a cloud database. So you didn't have this local versus cloud split in the same way. So like the environmental change was not that different. Though, if you're already implementing a cloud environment for your production and you're already thinking about how that works, adding a local prod version of that, so long as you have your tunneling things figured out, which is kind of the key question is like permissions and tunneling and how are you doing it? We were operating in a trustless mode for everything. Like we didn't have, oh, this is trusted network and this is not, which once again, that setup makes that a lot easier to generalize. If you're having the we're inside the cluster, so we're trusted type of setup, it's a lot harder to implement a local production environment. But yeah, I mean, I think coming back to this question of debugging, you're totally right, Jared. Like a lot of debugging is in flow of development. When I think about debugging, I don't even think about that. That's just like, that's development. Okay. I'm like working on that and whatever the tool is for the job. When I think about debugging, a lot of times, like the things that I would get brought into, especially my last few positions, it's like, this is something that happens somewhere in production and we don't know why, and we don't know what reproduces it. And like, so sometimes it's figuring out how do you get to reproducibility. In some cases, you can't even, there is no way to get to reproducibility. It only happens when certain things align. And so then it really becomes about how do you, it is this like observability question, extension of logging, of like, how do you get enough stuff in place in your application environment so that when the problem happens, the information is captured, enough information is captured that you can reproduce what actually went on there. And I do think in that situation, like the console log quote-unquote debugging is a closer mindset to that, but it's really like we're starting to talk about observability and this question of like, how do you log out sufficient application state to understand what went on when you're looking at it after the fact, rather than I have an environment where I've reproduced an issue and I'm doing things and I'm able to tinker and go back and forth, which is where both the inflow of development debugging happens and also where like a debugger or tools like that tend to be very useful.
No, that's a really good point, K-Ball. I think for me, just listening to you, I was reminded of console.trace, something else that I'm like, you know, at one point in my career, I remember I just like substituted all my logs for traces, like super annoying, but like it was helpful, you know, annoying because you get this long output. But yeah, it's nice to be able to see how you got there. So, you know, I forgot that, yeah, you can't actually do that with a log.
Is that the same thing, but it like gives you a full stack trace? What does console.trace do?
It prints out, like, you know, if you, you know, give it a thing to print out, but then it after that, you see how you got here. So like we are in this function and before this, you know, we were in this function and this function. So it's kind of like your stack trace, but it gives you that like, at, I don't know, 5 or 6, you know, lines deep of like everything that happened. What contexts were you in before you got to this context, basically, which is very, very helpful. But I think for me, you know, debugging is just like, it's about piecing together the map of your state, your application state. And I remember like the first time I debugged, it wasn't even in a JavaScript context. It was like in Python and Ruby and, you know, it's all these similar to the debugger statement in JavaScript. You know, there's in those languages, you can put like a binding pry or IPDB.
Right. Pry is tool in Ruby.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, you just immediately open up this REPL context where you can actually query and see like, okay, what is my application state right now? And I think for me, like that's the secret sauce power of being able to actually stop and pause in an execution context, is like actually understanding like what are the values of all these variables right now and where's the disconnect? Because, you know, something's, you're there because something isn't happening as you expect it to be. And so I think that's very useful. And I think tools like TypeScript have reduced the need for some of that, to be honest. Like, I think there's a little more predictability in our overall state because of TypeScript, but still happens. Yes.
So Eric, in your work, when you get a ticket or you get an issue or a colleague comes to you and says, hey, I got this bug, you know, I can't figure it out. What do you generally do? Like, where do you start? What are the steps that you take to get through that?
The very first thing is always, all right, show me, you know, with a video, reproducible repo, you know, something like that. It's kind of like, you know, have we logged enough? If I find myself going to Datadog to like look at raw logs for what happened, mm-hmm. I already know I'm going to be having a bad day. I'm like, this is too far in.
Yeah.
I know I'm missing off on like network requests and everything. Yeah. But once you get into, okay, I can point to where the problem is. It's kind of like normal development, like you mentioned, Jared. Is that like, you know, we're constantly like logging, seeing what the state is of how something's working. And I have a nagging voice in the back of my head that's like, you know, you're putting all these console logs in here, and I have a personal rule that's like, it's okay for bugs to happen once. Hopefully employers aren't listening, but you know, it's okay for bugs to happen once, but just not twice. And so anytime I do something ephemeral, like putting in a console log that ultimately gets deleted from that bug, that nagging voice is saying like, well, you know, you could have been doing test-driven development for this, right? You know, couldn't this have been a test to make sure it doesn't happen again instead of you just logging out, I wasn't doing like a type check here. Now the undefined isn't happening and I fixed it. So that's usually how like the flow goes is, you know, identification, reproduction, you know, and then whether or not it's that fix is going to be resilient to more code changes in the future.
I think there's something really important in that, which is trying to identify not just what was the immediate source of this bug, but what is the underlying fragility, whether it's in our processes or our systems or whatever, that led to this bug being possible. And like, bugs are going to happen. Mm-hmm. We are all human. Humans make mistakes. But you can often start to detect things like that where you might say, oh, we're using JavaScript instead of TypeScript. And so we have this whole set of things. Maybe if we move to TypeScript, this wouldn't be possible. Or we have a set of types that are not sufficiently constrained here. And so we're running into challenges. Or maybe you can say, oh, this system is developed in a way or works in a way such that it results in lots of buggy code. It's really hard to work with and people tend to misinterpret it because the API is shaped funny or something like that. Okay, Like, let's identify those patterns that lead to the bugs and then say, okay, when we have time, or let us make some time, how do we address that systemic issue so this class of bugs completely disappears, not just let's, you know, whack-a-mole them down as they show up?
Yeah, well said. And I think, Eric, your point about adding tests, I mean, there's no better time to add a test than when you've just fixed a bug, because now you know exactly one thing that could go wrong. And you can add a test that just makes sure that at least that one particular thing is never going to go wrong again. And so even if you don't TDD it, you can at least add a regression test after the fact that just tests for that bug. But it actually is a good way to debug, is once you know what the problem is.
I was going to say, even better is before.
Yeah, you write that as a test and then you make the test pass and life is good from there. I will say, when it comes to actually identification, so I've worked on a lot of network systems, I've worked on a lot of web apps and stuff, and there are certain people that you work with over time who are just really good at finding. You know, like a lot of times you got to find the bug. Like, that's a lot of the work, right? And so reproducibility is like the name of the game. It's like, how do I reproduce this? And sometimes you can just get yourself in like this general arena of the bug, but you're not really sure exactly what's going wrong, but you know it's not this subsystem or that subsystem. It's over here in this subsystem. And you're trying to like feel around in the dark, depending on your tooling. It could be more or less dark, right? But a lot of times it is, for what exactly is causing that circumstance. And people that I've learned from that are really good at that. Some of it eventually expertise turns into intuition, and they'll just kind of know what's wrong. And you're like, how did you do that? And they can't describe it. And you're like, dang.
I feel it in my fingers.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. See, I found an opportunity to sing.
I know, but then you stopped short. We want you to launch into it. Eric will grab his guitar, and then Cable and I will just dance.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we'll just be squashing bugs.
Oh, an actual party. But if you don't have that intuition, I'll say this, is only change one thing at a time. Mm. Like, that's how you find it, right? You keep everything, like, ceteris paribus, everything else is the same. I'm going to change one input. I'm going to test it. Then I'm going to put that input back to what it was. I'm going to change my next thing. I'm going to test it. Never change three things and then see, oh, I reproduced it all of a sudden. Well, which one was it? I changed three. Those three together? Or was it two of the three? Or is it just that one? I don't know. Now I have six more things I have to go try before I actually have confidence that the bug is fixed. So that's like the best, for me, advice when you don't have the intuition. Eventually you'll get there, I think. If you develop long enough, just change one thing at a time until you land on it.
When you mentioned that intuition, is that intuition, how much of that is the building up of the skill of, you know, being able to identify like where problems can happen, those types of problems, you know, the entire classes that we ideally want to remove? Or is it intuition of how the system works, like where the system's fragile, where the system's resilient,
right?
That sort of thing.
Yeah, I would say that I've seen it be both. It's kind of a hard to actually dissect that and say either or, because I've been with people who are like deeply into a system, like they know that system inside out, and that's the guy or gal that you're going to go to with the bug because they know the system. And then I've also I have one individual in mind specifically who's like, he's just good at finding bugs in anything. And so it didn't matter if he has the domain expertise or he wrote that subsystem or not. It's like, hey, George or whatever, I'll keep it anonymous to not embarrass somebody with compliments. He's just good at debugging things generally. And it's like, he just knows how to, I don't know. So I've seen people that are kind of in both camps. Is that aligned with you guys or?
Yeah, that's very aligned with my experience. There's some people who have just been doing this for so long. They are very familiar with, you know, oh, you're seeing this type of thing you're seeing this problem and it has these symptoms. Oh, it's likely due to XYZ. Like, and they don't know your system at all, right? Like,
right. They're like, it's DNS. And you're like, no, it's not DNS. And then like 17 hours later,
right,
it was DNS.
Right. And then there's the people who've been there so long, they're familiar with all the problems, right? Like, they're like, oh, when this thing happens, it's because, you know, this API system and this thing are down. Like, they're very, very familiar with the specifics of that, you know. And to that, I would say that, like, you know, when you're so familiar, when you've like been there long enough that you know all the things that are, you know, that could go wrong, it's like, maybe we should be putting more resilience and, like, you know, strengthening that part of the code if it's so problematic that, like,
yeah,
everyone knows that when this thing happens, it's this problem, you know. But yeah, I mean, for me, you know, the debugging is, I think Eric kind of mentioned this earlier, right? It's really your best way of, I think, kind of reducing that time to kind of solving a problem is, you know, what's your observability stack? You know, because I think that's, I don't feel like teams invest in that enough often. Like, it's always an afterthought, right? Like, observability, both from just analytics metrics, things like Sentry, all kinds of just ways to kind of log out your application state and getting a baseline. You know, the sooner you have all that stuff in, you have a baseline of normal, quote unquote, you know, and it's easier to kind of see when things are going haywire, right? You can set thresholds, you can monitor for changes, et cetera. So I would say really don't sleep on observability. It's very much like the public health versus kind of ER, you know, like proactive versus reactive. But it usually really like goes a very long way into kind of reducing how long it takes you to figure out like what's going wrong. It's an important part of the debugger's toolkit.
I want to take something that Jared said and extend it. So Jared, you talked about changing one thing at a time. I think that is an example of something that I've found to be very important with debugging, which is just being extremely systematic about understanding what is true and what is not true. I've found with a lot of newer engineers or people who struggle with debugging, they'll jump to conclusions about what's probably going on and then spend their time trying to like verify that conclusion. And it comes back to like, you can never... it's hard to prove something is true. It's much easier to prove something is not true. And so I always start with, okay, like, what is going on? Like, show me the situation.
What is going on? Yeah, that's what Eric said earlier. Yeah, show it to me.
What do we know is true? What do we know is true? Can we confirm that, right? So like going back to if we're using logs or we're using a debugger or whatever, like if you know the error is happening in a particular function, don't jump to somewhere down in the function and try to figure it out. Like, log out what is true when you enter that function. What arguments were passed? Do those match your expectations? Or is there something unexpected happening on there, right? Like, start from validating those very basic fundamental assumptions, because usually bugs don't arise because our assumptions were correct and then we implemented it wrong. Usually they arise because there was a gap in our assumptions. We were assuming that something would be true that it turns out in some situations is not true. And so the sooner that you can get to the point of like, oh, here is the place where my assumptions are not being validated, the sooner you're going to be able to figure out, okay, why? And is the problem that I need to handle this other case, or is the problem that something upstream is breaking and sending me invalid things? Like, it gets you arrowed into that much quicker. But I think a lot of folks start with like, oh, I think the problem's here, and they jump right in and they never take the time to validate their assumptions and move systematically.
Brilliant. It reminds me just how little we do as kind of like engineers to kind of test for like the non-happy paths. Those assumptions are baked into so much code. I mean, you can look at failure states. And it's actually kind of one of the beautiful things about being in the front-end space as a web developer is, you know, that's a portable skill, you know, of being able to work in the browser. You hand me a URL, something's going wrong. I'm going to be able to look at these really rich tools that you don't get when you console log in Node. I can actually expand out like, you know, variables and copy to the console, like you mentioned. It's almost always like at the network layer where we see that, you know, some happy path assumption isn't true anymore. And then that's whenever all the problems arise.
I'll give one other bit of generic advice. This may be more along the while I'm coding, troubleshooting, debugging, less so than just like, here comes a production ticket. In my experience, it's almost always your code. And this is just a humbling, I mean, it, 9 times out of 10. So, I mean, sure, the further you get away from your code, the least likely it is to be where the problem lies. You know, the fact, like, is it in the Linux kernel? That's probably not, right? Is it in Node.js? Probably not. Now, there are bugs there. There are problems and there are things that change out from under you. But that's like the 1 in 10 case. It's like, well, Node's API has a bug in this version. And it's most of the time, 9 times out of 10, if you're looking for the problem, look in your code and then look in the code that's touching your code and then work your way down. Because I, especially as a young man, would like immediately, I was a Ruby on Rails developer, and I would like dive into the Rails code base immediately and be like, what, you know, what are they doing wrong this time? And it was like always me. I was like, wait a second, talk about checking your assumptions, right? So just be humble enough to like start with your own code and stay there for a while, even when you can't find it, before you decide I'm going to hop into Chrome DevTools and open up the source code for the DevTools. Maybe the DevTools are actually printing this wrong. You know, like that's how strongly I would not let myself be the source of the bug. So it's almost always your fault.
Almost always.
Yeah.
But there are, it is almost always true. And you are absolutely correct. That's where you should start. And we did an episode where we shared debugging horror stories. And I will say the horror stories usually have to do with something in the environment.
Yeah. That's why I said nine times out of 10. I mean, if you do enough bugs, I mean, 1 out of 10 is a decent clip, right? If you can do 100 bugs a month, you know, it's going to be somebody else's fault. And that's a made up number, of course, but it's almost always yours.
Everything was working till you put your code in, right? And then now it's broken. So yeah, yeah. That is the one variable is yourself.
Yeah. It's also the thing that you can control the best. You know, upstream bugs are the worst because now you're like opening a ticket. It goes into a queue, right? Hopefully you have a workaround that you can do for now. And then you put a little note in there like, once this issue gets closed, I can take out this monkey patch or whatever. And then that lives for like 7 years in the code base, of course. But the further away the bug is from your code, actually the less agency and autonomy you have. And so it's better that it is your own because you can just change your own code. Whereas upstream, you got bigger problems. But they do happen.
Have you used patch package for issues like that?
No, please explain.
So I see K-Ball's nodding over there. I discovered it a few years ago, but effectively you find an issue in some upstream package, something in your node modules. You try your code. Your code's flawless as usual. And so you trace up and then you find like it's some sort of node module and you go in there and you change the code for the node module and you fix it. So what this patch package does is it'll do a diff of your node module, create a diff of that, generate a PR for the upstream package that has the issue. Meanwhile, anytime like you install that dependency again for anyone else on your team, a patch will be applied to it. A Git patch will be applied to it. So that way, like your fix for it before it lands upstream is at least in your project and you can benefit from it. So it works pretty well in my experience, with the exception of the more transpilation NPM projects have, you know, where they have like one single index.js file that's, you know, giant. It makes, you know, the utility a little bit lower.
Yeah, it's really useful. It works best also with projects that are likely to accept your patch sooner, because the more there's churn, like if you update the package, you need to now update your patch in patch package, because otherwise it won't necessarily apply cleanly if there's been other change around. So if you have a package that changes frequently but doesn't accept your change, it can either you're pinning to the version that you have or you're having to continually keep redoing that work.
Yeah, I don't see how it would work without pinning a version, because if you can't guarantee your merge is going to get accepted, it's like you're risking it just randomly breaking for others. But that's so cool, Eric. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, I'll link that one up in the show notes.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just like, you know, open source code is battle tested. There's more people using it. So to like Jared's point, like, yeah, start with your code first, because it's likely the least, especially if it's new, the least battle tested code in your stack, you know. But I mean, considering that like only 1 out of every 10 lines is code that you write in your application, like for every 10 lines that you ship, 9 of those are from third-party libraries. Like it's pretty amazing that we don't have more issues.
A large surface area.
Yeah, more issues around the integration layer.
It is. Sometimes I'm still amazed at all that works, you know?
It's really amazing. It's amazing. And not only that, just with security issues too, like that there's not more burning security issues every time. So that's also very impressive.
All right. Do we have any final thoughts on debugging, tools you like, etc., before we call this a conversation?
I just know I want to look into Replay. I've seen a lot of discussion about it, replay.io. And the biggest question I kind of have is like, when a bug has already happened, how can I get to that replay? You know, does it require like Chrome extension? Does it require an app to be running? What does this mean for like an end user versus as a developer tool? And I don't have the answers. I don't know if anyone else has used it. But the promise of something that can give me a replayable, you know, session is that's where I want to be, like developer experience. I want to do my job normally, let the bugs normally happen like they do, and then try to just go back in time and be like, okay, now let's pretend the code was actually this and I did it right the first time around. Now, does it play through cleanly? That's where I would like to be in a developer world. Of not have to like have that stop because of an error, in that cold start problem again.
Right. Yeah, if reproducibility is the biggest time sink for us and like the one that you have to work through, if you can provide that, like you can reduce the time to reproducibility and provide an option to like just replay history with this code versus the code that currently exists, I mean, you're going to save a lot of people a lot of time. And so that's great. I haven't seen this before.
Yeah. Do you want to just give people context for what replay is, Eric? Just like, and if it's available outside of like the React world or?
I unfortunately don't. It's one of those tools to where like, you know, you gotta invest the time into like researching it. But it's only been like ephemeral of like, I brought up the Tim Nukins quote earlier and it struck a chord with me. Like, yeah, super complicated bug that would have been days to reproduce. I spent some time over at AWS and like every customer's environment's different. And because of that, the way one thing behaved would be entirely different from something else because of some statefulness of their specific backend. And it's like, oh, if only I could see exactly how their backend was configured, I'd be able to figure this out. So I think that's kind of like the thing is that like having, like K-Ball mentioned, like, you know, where I'm at now is similar where we use like production data with like a low, and that's been fantastic. So if that were extended even further would like introduce, you know, time and recording into production, like real data with like local files, that would be my sweet spot for, you know, just day-to-day work. And naturally part of that is like debugging.
Y'all remember back in the day with when Redux first came out, I think the biggest kind of like aha was the time travel debugging, you know, feature. And it was, you know, and I heard this straight from the maintainers. It's funny, actually, Mark Erickson, as well as Ryan Vaughn from the React team and Mark Erickson, both friends of mine, now work at Replay, the startup that you're talking about. But Mark is one of the maintainers for Redux. And he mentioned that, like, surprisingly, like, not that many people took advantage of time travel debugging, you know, and despite it being the thing that people were most excited about, because it gave that predictability of, like, your state and being able to replay it. I'm curious to see if, I think maybe replay.
Did he say why that was the case? Maybe it was too hard to do, or?
I think config setup, there's, you know, just the ecosystem, the pipeline around kind of like, okay, once you capture the replay, how can you see it? Right? I think that's the replay, the startup is actually kind of smoothing that experience out. So I'm
right. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah. So if they make it a service, I'm excited to see if there's more adoption around it. So
because a mixed app that has more than Redux wouldn't get to benefit from time travel debugging, only the state from the Redux stores.
Right.
And I think that's kind of the problem is that like, it's kind of like betting on the web and betting on the environment we're in. Is that like all the statefulness that really matters is there in the browser. Is there when you're doing that console log or your debug. So if the time travel part is kind of, if the statefulness is managed there, that's the ideal irrespective of how I had, you know, how my app looks today in Redux versus MobX versus Prisma or whatever else the next, you know, iteration is.
Well, and this is pointing towards something that might be worth touching on, which is writing code that is debuggable.
Mm.
And one of the biggest sources of challenge, as we've highlighted, is reproducibility. Reproducibility has to do with state. You have to get this thing, whatever it is, into the state that reproduces the bug. The more that you can separate state from functionality and implementation and have your state encapsulated and then have your functions encapsulated, and this is pointing towards functional styles of development, this is pointing towards declarative development, which was a direction we've kind of moved in for a lot of web front-end stuff, at least. But the more you could separate those things out so that you can test your logic independent of your state and pass in all sorts of different states. And the more that you have state in a place that it's easy to snapshot it and replay or do things like that, the more debuggable your code is going to be and the easier all of this is going to be.
Well said. All right. We are hitting up against our time here. Eric, thanks so much for coming on the pod today. We'd love to have you back anytime. Don't need to wait for a Mel or another debate episode. Just give us a holler if you got something to talk about. We'd love to have you on the show more often. Where can people connect with you? Where can they get to know you, talk to you, etc. on the internet besides going to Texas and finding your house? I mean, that would be weird.
Just over barbecue or something.
I'm
still on the Twitters at Eric Clemens. So just my full name. Otherwise, you know, the GitHub. But Twitter's the best place to ping me.
Sounds good. Amel K-Ball, thanks for debating with us as masterfully as you always do.
I don't like debates, but this was fun. I don't do well with time pressure.
Hey, I mean, on this debate, we won, you won, the listener won, mm-hmm. we all win. So it doesn't get any better than that. Maybe because it's Friday, we're recording on a Friday, and I'm just feeling gracious today. You know, I'm just allowing others to finally get in on the good wins that I usually rack up. The only person who lost today, let's be honest, it was Nick Nisi, because A, he didn't win the debate, and then B, we barely mentioned
his beloved TypeScript.
So that's two losses for Nick, which is a good note to end on. I'm Jared. This is JS Party on behalf of Amel Cable and our guest, Eric Clemens. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with an awesome episode, I'm sure. So stick around and we'll talk to y'all on the next one. If you enjoyed this Yep, Nope debate episode, we have a bunch of them in the back catalog. We've debated if React is now only good at being popular, if modern JS tooling is too complicated, if SPAs were a big mistake, if websites should work without JS, if JavaScript itself needs rebranding, and more. Head to jsparty.fm and type Yep, Nope in the search bar. You'll dig up a bunch of goodies. And if you have a premise you'd like us to debate next, tell us about it. Request an episode at jsparty.fm/request. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks once again to our partners for helping us bring you JS Party each and every week. Check them out at fastly.com, fly.io, and typesense.org. And of course, thank you to our Beat Freakin' residents, Breakmaster Cylinder. That's it, this one's done, but we'll party again next week.